From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Mike Hammer is the quintessential hard-boiled detective. He's the creation of the quintessential hard-boiled detective writer, Mickey Spillane. On this edition of Fresh Air, Mickey Spillane tells us about The Killing Man, his first new Mike Hammer novel in 19 years. Rock critic Dave Marsh has written a new book telling the history of rock and roll through the 1001 best singles ever recorded. Coming up, he plays us the first and last record on his list. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Busoni's Piano Concerto, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Time Passages, George Lipsitz's analysis of popular culture since World War II. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Lebanon's newly elected Christian president, René Mouawad, was assassinated today in an explosion that blew apart his heavily guarded motorcade in Syrian-patrolled West Beirut. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the blast, which killed at least 20 other people, including three members of Mouawad's family and eight bodyguards. Mouawad's election was bitterly opposed by Christian General Michel Aoun. Aoun today expressed deep regret at Mouawad's killing. President Bush said today he sent in a specially trained commando group to rescue 12 American soldiers trapped in a hotel seized yesterday by leftist rebels in San Salvador. Some Pentagon officials expressed surprise at the president's revelation. Bush dispatched two plane loads of special operations squads specially trained to conduct guerrilla warfare, counter-terrorist operations, and hostage rescues. And they were positioned near the hotel, but the soldiers never went into action because the rebels left. Today's anti-government demonstration in Prague is the biggest so far in nearly a week of protests, and for the first time it has been publicly supported by a former party leader, Alexander Dubček. As the BBC's Philip Short reports from Prague, despite the growing size of the demonstrations, there is still no sign that the party leader, Miloš Jakeš, is willing to step down.
The chants of "Long live Dubček," a representative of the opposition Civic Forum, read out a message from the disgraced leader of the Prague Spring, the man who 21 years ago tried to give this country communism with a human face, calling on the party leadership to step down. As their names were read out, each was greeted with a howl of derision from 100,000 voices. But President Gustav Husak, the party leader Miloš Jakeš, and the others on Mr. Dubček's list are plainly determined to hang on to power.
The leaders of Eastern Airlines Pilots Union voted today to end their bitter sympathy strike and notified the company they were ready to return to work. The abrupt decision, 8 months into the strike by the carrier's machinist union, deals a severe blow to both the machinist and organized labor, which has used the pilot's support of the strike as a symbol of newfound solidarity. Clement Haynsworth died today of a heart attack. Haynsworth's nomination by President Nixon to the Supreme Court was rejected by the Senate because of questions about his judicial ethics and views on minorities. The retired federal judge died at his home in Greenville, North Carolina, at the age of 77. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 17 points to close at 2656.78. This is NPR News. Bright lights are shining on the Space Shuttle Discovery tonight as NASA makes final preparations for a rare nighttime launch. NPR's Richard Harris reports from Florida.
The countdown clocks here read all zeros right now because this is a secret military mission, so NASA isn't saying exactly when launch will be. The clocks will start up at T-minus 9 minutes, and some sources say that could be within the next half hour. Five astronauts are on board Discovery, including Frederick Gregory, who's the first black man to command a shuttle mission. The astronauts are reportedly going to spend 4 days in space, and experts believe their primary mission is to deploy an electronic eavesdropping satellite over the Soviet Union. Discovery is also carrying astronauts trained to do spacewalks, but there's no word about whether a spacewalk is planned for this secret mission. The weather here in Florida is warm and clear right now, so officials are optimistic that Discovery will blast off tonight. This is Richard Harris at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
Panamanian General Manuel Noriega today unanimously was elected head of the National Assembly of Representatives, the country's newly revived legislative body. Noriega had been expected to be nominated head of government, a position that would have given him power to take part in decisions by the cabinet. It is not immediately clear why he was not given that title. Scientists said today that fossils recently discovered in East Greenland indicate that the earliest known land vertebrates may have breathed through their ears. The discovery contradicts the accepted view that the first land animals with backbones had an eardrum. According to researcher Jennifer Clack of Cambridge University, the evolution of the middle ear is central to a discussion of how four-footed animals adapted to life on land. The new findings are published in the journal Nature. They're based on a group of large fossils found in 1987 in an English-Danish expedition to East Greenland, an area that was once a lush tropical forest. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now some people may know him best for his Tough Guy light beer commercials, but Mickey Spillane is the creator of one of America's most popular hard-boiled private eyes. Spillane wrote his first Mike Hammer novel in 1947. I, the Jury was followed by 11 other Hammer stories, including Vengeance is Mine, The Big Kill, and Kiss Me Deadly. The character of Mike Hammer has also had a life in movies and on TV, but it's been 19 years since the last Mike Hammer novel, and now at the age of 71, Mickey Spillane has written a new one. It's called The Killing Man. Six of his earlier Hammer novels are being republished. Spillane lives in South Carolina, and his home was recently torn apart by Hurricane Hugo. I asked Mickey Spillane why he decided to bring Mike Hammer back.
It wasn't a case I brought him back. He never left. All these years I've had him out there on television land doing the series and doing motion pictures, and then I was playing the part of Mike Hammer in a characteristic style for the light beer commercials, you know, pork pie hat, trench coat, the doll. So his image was always up there in front of the public. But the reason I brought him back was because when I was on tour around the United States these past 16 years for light beer, people kept asking me, when are you going to write another book? Now, I wasn't ready to do it because I had overcharacterized the character as far as I was concerned. I needed that little break. And when I come back, it was nice and fresh. Of course, Mike Hammer isn't the same age as I am. I used to keep him my age deliberately. But now he's 45, 46 years old, while I'm 71. And he's going to benefit by my age and experience.
How do you think he's changed with the times?
Oh, he doesn't change. Mike Hammer's a state of mind. The city is the city. He works here. Somebody said something smart to me the other day because I thought nobody ever picked it up, but I use New York City not as a background but as a character. And the city actually is a character in my books. It creates moods. It does things, but it moves around with the people. And there's never been a physical description of Mike Hammer. As I said, he's a state of mind.
Why haven't you ever physically described him in the novels?
Because this way every man can put himself into Mike's shoes. You know, if you say he was short and fat, how would a tall, skinny guy do it? But he's known by his prowess, by his mental abilities, if you're going to give him any mental abilities. But he's a person, as anybody would be.
Does this mean that in your mind's eye, he's you?
No, he's not me. No, I don't go out and researching bullets anymore. You know, those days are gone for me. I'm a spectator sportsman now. But, you know, like I like to say, a writer of fiction is really a professional liar. You write these things and people believe it. You know, Mike Hammer gets more mail than I do. When the book comes out, I'm going to be flooded with mail to Mike Hammer. Strange, isn't it? But I'm glad to see that. I'm not complaining.
Mickey Spillane is my guest, and he has his first new Mike Hammer novel in 19 years. It's called The Killing Man. When you started writing the Mike Hammer novels, did you have a sense of what you wanted to do different from the other detective novels that you'd read?
Yeah, sure, because I started back when there were no books with this. The first book had a big sensual ending, and it wasn't sensual primarily so. This was a psychological drama, and nobody had done one like this before. And I came out with it. It was interpreted in various ways and run down by the critics as being lurid and whatnot, but it sold, and this is what things have come to now. Today, I don't write like people on the pornography is so prevalent it's disgusting, because you just cannot write a book about pure sex or pure violence. Those are exclamation points in a book. They happen here and there, but the rest of the story is a story about life.
I'm going to ask you to read something from your first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury. And this is from early on the book. It's like page 5, and I think it's a nice setup of what the character is like when you're first introducing him to readers. And this is a conversation that he's having with a friend of his who's a cop.
Ready?
Yeah.
When I looked up, Pat was staring at me strangely. He shook his head. I knew what he was thinking. Mike, lay off. For God's sake, don't go half-cocked about this. I know you too well. You'll start shooting up anyone connected with this and getting a jam you'll never get out of. I'm over it now, Pat. Don't get excited. From now on, I'm after one thing, the killer. You're a cop, Pat. You're tied down by rules and regulations. There's someone over you. I'm alone. I can slap someone in the puss and they can't do a damn thing. No one can kick me out of my job. Maybe there's no way to put up a huge fuss if I get gunned down. But then I still have a private cop's license with the privilege of pack a rod and they're afraid of me. I hate hard, Pat. When I latch onto the one behind this, they're going to wish they hadn't started it. Someday, before long, I'm going to have my rod and my mitt and the killer in front of me. I'm going to watch the killer's face. I'm going to plunk one right in his gut when he's dying on the floor and may kick his teeth out. You couldn't do that. You have to follow a book because you're a captain of homicide. Maybe the killer will wind up in a chair. You'd be satisfied, but I wouldn't. It's too easy. That killer is going down like Jack did.
Well, I think this sets up the character pretty well. And that whole sense of, and when he's dying on the floor, I may kick his teeth out.
Yeah. How about that?
So, I mean, what does that say about the character? I mean, what did you want to get in there?
Well, the character, something terrible has been done to Mike. His best friend has been shot. Not only shot, but has been shot in a horrible way because the killer wanted to see that guy hurt. Because shot him where it wasn't a death-dealing blow with that shot. He shot him in the gut. He's going to live a while. He's going to be in terrible pain. And that's the way that killer's going to die. So this is the premise of the whole story, that killer's going down just like Jack did, his friend did. And that's what happens.
And Mike Hammer says that in the end, the people have their justice. They get it through guys like me once in a while. You've made Hammer into the guy who's going to get justice outside of the law.
That's right. In this case, he's acting as an arm of the law, but in a different way. He can do things that nobody else can do. He's got more reason for doing it. He's not hung up by rules and regulations the way the cop was. And it's a case of personal vendetta on his part. See, I never had Mike Hammer ever taking a case for money. Everything he ever got into was because of a personal motivation. Something happened to somebody he liked, somebody he loved, some situations were terrible, and he got into it, and with no money behind it. He was on his own all the way because this was a personal nature with him, and he needed all of his attention.
Hammer seems to take a lot of, almost pleasure in vengeance and in returning pain that's been received. Is it cathartic for you to write that way?
No, I never used that particular idea. When you're going into a tough situation, pain's going to be there. You don't want to dwell on these things. But there are certain episodes that require this type of thing. If you want to see pain, violence, sex, you read your newspapers. There's plenty of it there. We have to bring it in where it belongs in the book in order to make the book interesting. You just can't write all about that. Oh, I've had some bloody incidents. Sure, people like that. They see when you see pictures of body parts flying around, everybody's oohing and aahing, but they stay there to see this. But the way the people are today, it seems to make no difference at all. They're so used to these things. They see it on television for real during the war, the combat scenes during warfare and the things that are happening now in Beirut and all around the world and these plane crashes.
So you're saying your writing seems really tame by comparison?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But you can write about good scenes that would incorporate all this.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain rhythm. I mean, in some ways, I think you're really at your best when you're writing violent scenes. There's a certain rhythm that you get in those scenes.
Yeah, you can get mad when you write. I punch holes in my paper. The yo's make holes. The periods go right into the platen of the machine. I break up typewriters so fast. And when I'm done with a story, that machine has to go in for repair. So you know what I'd do to if I ever work with a word processor. I'd tear it apart.
At the end of I, the Jury...
Yeah.
Yeah. this is like perhaps your most famous scene?
Well, this is the one that's so well remembered. This is the one I told you about. They said it was a sensual scene. I see Mike, he's got a premise in his life. He is going to kill the person who killed his friend in the same way by shooting him in the gut. Now, at the end of the story there, when he's face down with this woman that he loves, Charlotte, she knows what he wants to do. She has to get him away from this attitude. She starts to unrobe. She takes her clothes off piece by piece. And the description is of her getting down to the point where she's nude. And then she leans over while she's about to kiss him. She's really reaching for a gun behind his head. Now, if he's true to his premise, he'll stay alive. If he's not true to it, she's going to kill him. And, of course, what he does, he stays true. He shoots her right in the gut. Now, she's a psychiatrist. She couldn't understand that. And she says, how could you? And he says, it was easy. And that's the way he was. That was the end of the story.
And that's your most famous line, I think, that
it was easy.
Oh,
yeah, it was easy.
Was it considered very unusual to have the private eye kill a woman at the end of a book?
Well, they didn't used to do it in those days. Women were sort of held up on a pedestal. I knocked this one off. I've only killed, I think, two women. Made them villains in any of my stories, but they were effective.
Now, why is that something you wanted to topple in your story?
Women can be as deadly as men any time. Again, just refer back to your newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun doing it to them. Of course, there are other times when women are treated with much more consideration than that.
Were there any limits, editorial limits, censorship limits, to how much sex and violence you could use in the book and still be mass marketed? Were you always cognizant of what your limits were?
Well, the editors do funny things. When I wrote One Lonely Night, Mike Hammer killed off 200 people with a machine gun, kept reloading and shooting. He was in a commie nest, a real deadly area, and he shot 200 people. And the editor says, oh, that's much too much blood. So he knocked it down to 100 people.
That was supposed to be a big change.
That's your editorial concept.
In your novels, women lick their luscious lips seductively a lot.
Yeah.
I know I'm a woman and not a man, but I've really never seen a woman lick her lips.
you never were watching.
Perhaps.
That's a little game they play.
Have you seen that a lot? Because I remember.
Sure, I've seen it many times. The French said they make a moo, M-O-U-E.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is writer Mickey Spillane, and he's just completed his first Mike Hammer novel in 19 years. It's called The Killing Man. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mickey Spillane is my guest. He has his first Mike Hammer novel in 19 years, and it's called The Killing Man. Hammer is a violent guy, and everybody wonders if Mickey Spillane has been exposed to violence at all. I know that you were in World War II. Were you in combat then?
No, I didn't have to be. I was exposed to violence when I was a little kid. That's why I got a crew cut now after 70. I was 7 years old, and I lived in a crazy neighborhood where my mother wanted a girl and let my hair grow long. I had what they call a Buster Brown haircut. The kids would get me by my hair and hold me down and beat the garbage out of me. So I got my mother's scissors out one day and I cut all my hair off. Nobody's been able to do it to me since. So my life wasn't violent. I had a nice upbringing. Got into all sports, did all kinds of things. But violence per se is not in my backyard. I've been exposed to it. I've done a lot of police work. I've done a lot of reporting and seen these things happen, been involved in some of it. I don't take pleasure in any of it, believe me.
Well, I read that you were actually with the police on the bust of a narcotics ring.
Oh, I was on several of those big ones, yeah.
But that you took two bullets on one of them.
Well, I got one. Uh-huh. That was enough. Well, it was one shot, but it was a buckshot in the darn thing. Whenever you go out playing around, you're going to get hurt. So the best thing to do, don't go where trouble happens. Otherwise, you're going to be part of it, and then you can get clobbered. I'm not about looking for any of these things anymore. I'll use everything that's in my mind. I will use my imagination, I'll get into fiction and keep it that way. I don't want any more realism. That gets to be rough.
Well, this is a kind of weird question, but when you actually were shot, I don't know if this is too weird or not, but how did it compare with how you imagined it was when you had characters being shot in your books?
Well, it was a little bit screwy because I was standing behind a whole bunch of tomato paste. There was a slogan for this tomato paste. Who put those six big tomatoes in the itty bitty cans? And the bullet went through the cans, got everybody splashed with tomato paste, and everybody thought they'd all been shot as well.
Oh, gee.
So the shot just sprayed around, and it was...
How bizarre. Since you had tomato sauce all over, did you know, were you able to figure out right away where the actual wound was?
Yeah, you'll know right where that is,
right,
but
okay.
You're not considering that right away. All you know is everybody got clobbered, and that was, you know, it was kind of hard to get the tomato sauce off, though. It wasn't deadly, I'll tell you that.
So is the sensation something that you've recalled for writing?
No. You're better off if you use your imagination. You know, writing is something completely different. When you're writing fiction, it's easy. You can do things with fiction that nobody ever believed in. Words are great. They're expressive. You can say things that you'd never experience and make them sound real. Hey, that's what being a writer is all about. I have as much fun writing as I do have reading.
Mickey Spillane is my guest, and he's written his first Mike Hammer novel in 19 years. You've said that the first part of a story that comes to you is the ending, because that's where you have
sure.
to get to, and that's in your novels the most, the kind of, you know, the dramatic climax. Seems to me your titles come from the last page, too.
Not always. No. When you're writing, see, it's like a joke. The only part of a joke you listen to is that punchline. So when you develop a story, that's your important part, is the big ending on there. Now, O. Henry did this in all of his stuff, and he was an old-time writer. I've just gone ahead and elaborated on his style a little bit in the structure of a story. Titles come out of the air. I don't know where they come from, but when I was doing The Killing Man, we couldn't get a title for that. And we were writing down all sorts of titles. We put them on the computers looking for any duplications and whatnot. And I was sitting there, all of a sudden I looked at it, I said, The Killing Man, that's it. And just popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't try for a title until after the book is finished.
Mickey Spillane is my guest, and his new novel is called The Killing Man. It's his first Mike Hammer book in 19 years. You played Mike Hammer once in the film The Girl Hunter.
Yeah.
What did it feel like to be him on screen?
Beautiful. I had a great deal of fun with that because not only was I acting, I was in part of the production work, I'd written the script, I was in charge of casting, and so I'm not all that tall like some of these guys, these big 6 footers and all that stuff. I'm 5'8", and I didn't want to look like a little shrimp on screen, and I didn't want to wear high heels. I didn't want anybody walking in trenches and walking on apples. So what I did, I wouldn't hire anybody if they came above my eyes. And it's easy to find short actors. So I was able to swagger through the picture. You know, the next tallest one to me was my leading lady, Shirley Eaton. So I had a good time making the picture. I didn't forget the words because I had written them.
Something I recently learned about you is that you are or were, I'm not sure which, a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, I've been a Jehovah's Witness since 1951.
You know, what surprised me about that was that I know you're not your character, but, I mean, Hammer is such the man alone that it seemed like hard for me to fathom that you were, you know, part of an organized religion.
Well, I'm not going to discuss it with you now, but next time one of Jehovah's Witnesses knocked on the door, call them in. They'll tell you all about it. But religion's a strange thing, you know. It's something you have personally in your lives, and you got to believe in it, and I believe in what I believe in.
Can I ask if the witnesses have ever objected to your books?
No. I don't think they read them, and I don't blame them. But... what you're writing is just this is a job with me. I don't write for any express purpose like passing messages around. It's strictly a job. I try to keep them fairly contemporary and fairly clean. The first time I used a four-letter word in a book, I thought the publisher was going to go out of their minds, and this was a long time after it was coming out in other books. I don't try to use bad language, mainly because these are, again, our exclamation points within the story. And I try to keep things as... normal as possible. Anybody wants to read violence and sex, go to the newspaper. There's plenty of it there.
Something else I recently learned about you is that you collect blue willow pottery.
Yeah.
Which is a surprising hobby for a hard-boiled guy.
Well, it's not a one-time blue willow was just cheap kitchenware for all the farm ladies all over the country. It was made by different companies, but there was a classic thing about it. It was all excellently made. It was great chinaware. Cheap, very cheap. But now it's up on the stage where, you know, it becomes antique and looks nice. And I lost a whole mess of it down
in the hurricane.
And my wife collects pewterware, and she lost her pewterware. And But we'll get it back. There's a lot of it out there, and the fun is going out collecting these things and doing it again. And I like it. It's useful, it's pretty looking, and reminds me of my childhood, because we had it at home.
Well, speaking of your childhood, your father was a bartender?
Yeah, he was a good Irish bartender in Brooklyn.
So did you hang out at that bar?
No, I would never hang out at a bar because I don't like the atmosphere of a bar. It's nobody goes into a bar to get sober. And again, it's a trouble spot. Bar scenes where you have restaurants, well, this is a different situation. But when you speak of a bar, you know what you're speaking of is like a neighborhood pub type of bar where everybody's in there and they finally, it's a place where they go and they don't want to go home. But I don't hang around in those places. Mm-hmm. I never did.
How did you start doing light beer commercials?
Oh, they asked me to do it, and I loved it. We brought that beer from nothing right up to the second largest selling beer in the world. And it was a pleasure to do it. 16 years worth is a long time. But we did the commercials right through, did a lot of public appearances all over the United States.
How do you think the private eye field, the literary field, has changed in the 19 years that you weren't writing books?
They got into things like with the CIA, into... a little more exotic areas than plain old murder. But the thing is with murder, see, you'll never get away from murder. I mean, the murder is there. That's a simple crime. It can be a major catastrophe, but it's something you don't have to get involved with governmental action. You don't have to, but it can all tie in. Murder is the basis of all of my stories. I really get out into the spy field or get involved with anything else like that.
The CIA figures into your new novel. Did you feel like you had to keep up in a way with the changes in the field?
Oh, no. I was just doing it because it was handy. It was a thing to do. And it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
I never played a cop's town. I have the greatest respect in the world for police departments. I'll tell you what, even if a cop is on the take, this is a cop that's going to protect you. He'll run right down a black alley after a guy who's got a machine gun in his hand just to save your life or protect you. So the cops are, these are very dedicated persons. They're highly underpaid, I'll tell you that. But they're great people to know and to work with.
How involved were you with the My Camera TV series?
Oh, I do anything I want with the TV series, but I didn't bother to because when you have, I'm living down in South Carolina, and this is all being put together out in California, so I let Jay Bernstein handle it all, and he did a good, competent job of it. You have trouble with things that start to wear out after a while, like storylines and whatnot. But we get in there if necessary and fix them up.
So you plan on doing more writing now, more novels?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to have another novel out next year. I got one almost finished now. That's the one that Hurricane Hugo blew all over the area.
Oh.
3/4 of the book went down a drain when my downstairs office got wrecked. I managed to save the first 2 chapters and the ending. And I know every word that I had written down on the other pages, so it'll be no big deal to getting it back together.
So you basically memorize what you've written, huh? I mean, you just remember.
No, I remember. It didn't memorize. It's just right there, and I know my style, and I know it'll come out almost exactly the way it went down initially.
So this is another My Camera book?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
People want them, they got them.
Mickey Spillane, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Mickey Spillane's new novel is called The Killing Man. It's a Mike Hammer story. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a rhythm and blues concert with Charles Brown. Hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rock critic Dave Marsh has compiled his list of the 1,001 best rock and soul singles ever made. Coming up, Marsh plays us number one and number 1,001. Also, commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews Time Passages, Collective Memory, and American Popular Culture by George Lipsitz. The book examines how things like rock and TV have shaped our collective memory. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of what he calls one of the most ambitious works ever composed, Ferruccio Busoni's Piano Concerto. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The space shuttle Discovery roared into the Florida sky just minutes ago on a secret military mission. NPR's Richard Harris reports live from the Kennedy Space Center.
The space shuttle Discovery lit up the Florida sky for miles around as it blasted off about 8 minutes ago. And after that dramatic start, the shuttle is now well on its way to orbit. This is only the third time that NASA has launched a space shuttle at night. Five astronauts are on board, including Frederick Gregory, who was the first black man to command a space shuttle mission. The purpose of this mission is secret, but experts believe the astronauts will deploy a satellite to eavesdrop on Soviet military communications. Some astronauts on board are also specially trained to do spacewalks, but NASA is not saying whether a spacewalk is planned. Discovery is expected to touch down in the California desert Sunday night. This is Richard Harris at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
The leaders of Eastern Airlines Pilots Union have voted to end their sympathy strike and told the company that they are ready to return to work. This decision, 8 months into a strike by the carrier's machinist union, deals a severe blow to both the strikers and organized labor, which have used the pilot support of the strike as a symbol of solidarity. Eastern has been hiring replacement pilots and using the union pilots who crossed picket lines. Just before Congress adjourned, President Bush vetoed a bill affecting Eastern Airlines and its striking workers. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
Minutes before a midnight deadline last night, the president vetoed a bill that would have begun a special congressional investigation into the Eastern Airlines strike. Eastern's machinists have been on strike for 8 months. Within days of their walkout, the company filed for bankruptcy. And since then, it's been operating with replacement workers, which the union calls scabs. In his veto message, the president said that Congress had no business interfering in the negotiations or the court disputes currently underway between the union and Eastern's owners. Today, the machinists' union said the president has embraced the meanest worker-hating boss in the nation by his veto. Frank Lorenzo, Eastern's president, praised Bush for trying to keep the airline industry competitive. Congressional sponsors of the bill say they'll try to override the veto when they return in January. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Soviet news agency TASS says that 34 people were killed and 8 others injured yesterday in the crash of a Soviet airplane. The crash occurred in southwest Siberia. It was the fourth Soviet plane accident in 5 weeks. U.S. Embassy officials in Lima, Peru, say the body of a U.S. journalist has been found in the country's biggest cocaine-producing region. 28-year-old Todd Smith of Tampa had disappeared while carrying out research for articles that he planned to write. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 17 points to close at 2,656.78 on volume of 145 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The Busoni Piano Concerto is one of the most ambitious and neglected orchestral works ever written. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says a new recording of the piece, featuring pianist Garrick Olson with the Cleveland Orchestra, is sure to revive interest in it.
One of the most mysterious and original figures in modern music is the turn-of-the-century Italian piano virtuoso and composer Ferruccio Busoni. He was born in 1866 and died in 1924, the same year as Puccini. They even both wrote operas called Turandot. But there's very little further similarity. Puccini was purely a man of the theater, a popularizer. Busoni was an idealist, a theorist, an internationalist, and a great teacher. His favorite composers were the unlikely duo of Mozart and Liszt. Today, recordings of Busoni playing the piano are rare, and his major compositions are rarely performed. He's probably known best for his Bach transcriptions and his other ferociously difficult work based on Bach, the Fantasia Contrapuntistica. One of Busoni's most notorious pieces is his piano concerto, and there's a new recording by the Cleveland Orchestra under Christoph von Dohnányi with pianist Garrick Olson that may give it a new lease on life. Here's the grand entrance of the piano in the first movement. Busoni completed his piano concerto in 1904, and it immediately broke new ground. Most piano concertos had only three movements, until Brahms added a fourth to make the concerto more symphonic. Busoni's concerto has five. Beethoven used a chorus in his Ninth Symphony and a piano in his ambitious choral fantasy, but no one before, or to my knowledge after, Busoni has employed a chorus in a piano concerto. This grandiose 70-minute work, according to Busoni's original Mahler-like outline, depicts the ages of man. Before he dropped the titles, Busoni was going to call the first movement Expectation Before the Glory, the Mystery and the Call to Life. The second and fourth movements, based on the same tarantella, are manic scherzos, youth with its thousand fantastic plans, and the final refuge of the wild lust of life. These movements surround a mystical slow movement, maturity with its serious struggle for inner concord. Busoni said this movement was inspired by the melody he once heard entering the Strasbourg Cathedral at sunset. The last movement is the conscious and dispassionate withdrawal into the infinite. An unseen male chorus sings passages from the Danish poet Adam Gottlob Oehlenschläger's Aladdin. Lift your hearts, feel Allah near. The music may not be consistently inspired, but the performance is consistently gripping. Dohnányi holds the entire massive structure together. He can even make the Cleveland Orchestra sound vulgar when he has to, and that's when the concerto is the most fun. Olsen plays with extraordinary finesse, yet has astounding reserves of energy. He once said playing the Busoni concerto was like playing three Brahms concertos in a row, but his effort always sounds effortless. He gives one of the most stupendous keyboard performances on record.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Telarc recording of the Busoni Piano Concerto. This is Fresh Air. Dave Marsh has been writing about rock and roll ever since he was a teenager. Marsh turns 40 next year. He was one of the founding editors of Cream magazine and an early staff writer at Rolling Stone. Since 1983, he's published a monthly newsletter called Rock and Roll Confidential. Bruce Springsteen fans know Marsh as the author of Born to Run and Glory Days. In Marsh's new book, The Heart of Rock and Soul, he's rated what he considers the 1001 greatest singles ever made. I asked him why.
It seemed to me that the story of rock and roll had been told from this very narrow and actually inaccurate point of view that turned it into an Anglophile white boys club. And I thought, well, that's not what I listen to in the middle of the night when I'm really got my heart and soul on the line here. What I listen to is the music of black people, and it's got a lot of women involved in it and a lot of groups, and it came from various parts of the United States, and it's just people who have been obliterated by the way that history has been told. And so I thought, I'll get to write about the records I love, and I'll get to try to set some version of the record on paper that hasn't been told yet. And here we are today.
What do you mean when you say that the version of rock and roll that's always told comes out like an Anglophile white boys club?
Well, I mean simply that David Bowie's James Brown's knockoffs are given more importance than James Brown's original creations. I mean that it's taken for granted when people write about albums that something that professes seriousness is serious and something that professes triviality is trivial. Whereas for me, I might see something like the Madonna, like the Shangri-Las or Madonna, as being more serious than some relatively pompous postmodern dance band.
Mm-hmm. And why are you going with singles and not albums?
Because that's where that music gets made, because it is dance music and love songs and things that look trivial. If you look at albums, you do get a different perspective on history. You're never going to get Aretha Franklin or Marvin Gaye or even Chuck Berry right by trying to look at their history on LPs. They made that music song by song, record by record, and we experienced it and share it song by song, record by record. I guess that's another part of the singles mentality, is that it's the experience we share, because those, often as not, are the hits or even many times the obscurities that people have in common.
Okay, do you want to recite your top 10 for us?
But I need a book because I don't... You know, I took the ordering of these records seriously, but only up to a point. What the book is about is the relative placement. In other words, if a record's number one and how much better than number two could it be? On the other hand, if a record's number 100 and another record's number 853, then I think that there's a wide gap of difference between them. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you the top 10.
Okay.
So I Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye. Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Brown. Reach Out, I'll Be There by the Four Tops. You've Lost That Love and Feeling by the Righteous Brothers. These pages are rustling because I would get the order wrong. I know what the records are. Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones, Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, Respect by Aretha Franklin, Tutti Frutti by Little Richard, Nowhere to Run by Martha and the Vandellas, and number 11's Louie Louie, because I figured it had to be number one or it was cast into outer darkness.
Okay, why is Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine your choice for the number one single of all time?
Well, because you got to start somewhere, and because that seemed to me to open the door to lots of different kinds of discussion. It's a great dance song. It's an interesting love song. It's a great mood of mystery and paranoia. He's a fantastic singer. It's a great example of Motown record making. And I thought it was a record that a lot of people shared. I thought it was a record that communicated to a lot of people.
You know, in pop records, the importance of a record has as much to do with its place in your life as it does with the inherent musical qualities of the record. So how did that come into play when you were making your choices?
Well, if I chose my favorite record of all time, which I'm not even going to tell you what it is because that's just today, it wouldn't have been I Heard It Through the Grapevine at any given point. What this record is about is it's about trying to balance the most subjective judgments you ever have had to make in your life with some empirical realities, not only chart placement, but artistic stature, and trying to prove a point and make a case for a history of music that's different than the history that people have been given before. For instance, Nowhere to Run at number 10. It's about the fourth Motown record in the top 10. But it was the only record I thought that was close enough to make in the top 10, and I wanted more women in the list, in that part of the list, because I wanted those 10 records to make a certain point about that. And so I bumped it up above a couple of things that if I was going purely on subjective taste, my own, it wouldn't be in the top 10. And similarly, I decided to be bold and make a point by dropping Elvis out of the top 10, the Beatles out of the top 25, putting Jump, which is a record that I do indeed love, a little by Van Halen, a little higher. So the list is, you know, the book is meant to be a series of stories that add up to one big story. And at some point, I just decided to allow the list to take a way back seat to the making of a book that I thought would be more interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to skip all the way up to number 1001. Which is a record called No Way Out. And there's a great story behind how you heard and got a copy of this record. Would you tell the story, Dave?
I first heard No Way Out on a tape that was sent to me by the film critic Michael Goodwin and the music critic Greil Marcus. They sent me a tape, and this was the central thing on it as far as I was concerned. I sort of leapt to the telephone and I said, what is this record? This is a great record. They said, we don't know. And what the story is that Mike Goodwin, when he was at Cornell in 1959, every year the Cornell radio station would let people bring their singles in and they would play rock and roll during finals week. The rest of the time the station was classical. And Mike always worked at the station. His senior year he thought, I'm hearing records I'm never going to hear again in my life. I'm going to sit down the day after finals are over, take all the records, put them on reel-to-reel tape, and then I'll have them. And he spent a whole day sitting amongst, you know, old pizza boxes in this trashed-out studio doing that and writing, very assiduously writing down each artist's name and the title of the song. And he had the tapes, and he lugged them around from house to house. And about 4 years later or so, he was in New York, and he got these tapes out and decided to listen to them. Came across No Way Out and responded as one does if you're into that kind of New Orleans rhythm and blues music by leaping out of his chair. And he picked up the tape box and went, what is this song? and he had written down the title, but he had not written down the artist. And a 20-year search began. Mike played this record for tons of people, very erudite people about music. And he himself, I think, in the course of it, became much more erudite about music. He knows a lot about music, Michael Goodwin. Anyway, it got down, I think, he started dropping references into articles he wrote. I was looking for it. Grill Marcus was looking for it. Different people, what is this record? And we all knew it sort of sounded New Orleans style or L.A. style because a lot of New Orleans musicians moved to L.A. But I also thought it sounded kind of Chicago. And you would ask around. Finally, someone told Michael that it sounded like this New Orleans singer called Joyce Harris. And he tracked it down. That way. He found some other Joyce Harris records in New Orleans, and somebody finally tracked him down. But nobody knows who she is. Nobody knows where the record came from or any of the circumstances of the record's production. And I thought it was the completely perfect place. When I went into the book, I did not know what number one was, but I always knew that that was the last record in the book because it's the last record because there is no ending to this.
Well, I think it's also probably the last record because it's kind of a statement of how personal pop can be to you, or rock and roll can be to you. You know what I mean? That, I mean, who knows if this is really like the 1001st greatest record, but it's a really important record to you, one way or another.
Yeah, and I thought that this, you know, and to me also, the story's a paradigm. The story really is a paradigm of how this music that began in a kind of anonymity, in a concept that it would all be over in 6 months,
right,
has sustained a 30-year history. Going on a 40-year history, that there is continuity, and that the continuity is in some ways despite the intentions of the makers of the music themselves.
No Way Out, sung by Joyce Harris, number 1001 in Dave Marsh's new book, The Heart of Rock and Soul, the 1001 Greatest Singles Ever Made. Marsh is currently editing the papers of Woody Guthrie. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're up to at All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Lots of news today. Lebanon's new president has been killed in a bombing in Beirut. We'll have a discussion about the possible motives and the future of that country. Demonstrations continue in Czechoslovakia. A report from NPR's Deborah Amos from Prague, and we'll talk with a dissident about his hopes for new leadership in that country. And food shortage among the food banks of this country. There's been a drop-off in corporate contributions here at Thanksgiving time, and it's being especially missed. The food banks are down by 16%, and many people blame that on the leveraged buyouts of companies.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. George Lipsitz, a professor of history and American studies at the University of Minnesota, has just written a book that examines how pop culture has shaped America's collective memory since the end of World War II. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Time Passages.
My dream job would be to hold the Babalu Professorship of I Love Lucy Studies at a major university. To me, the Lucy Show is as rich a commentary on gender relations in the 1950s as Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. I think George Lipsitz would agree. Lipsitz is part of an exciting new generation of scholars who are rescuing TV shows, B-movies, rock music, and pulp fiction from the dustbin of history. He writes that the most important facts about people and about societies have always been encoded within the ordinary and the commonplace. Time Passages is an academic press book, but don't be scared off. Lipsitz quickly recovers from his occasional lapses into jargon. The book opens with a politically savvy and very funny discussion of the ethnic working class comedies that were popular during TV's golden age. Shows like The Life of Riley, Amos and Andy, Life with Luigi, The Goldbergs, and I Remember Mama. Lipsitz claims that these comedies legitimized the new consumer hedonism of the 50s for a generation still haunted by ghosts of the Depression and the Second World War. When Molly Goldberg criticized her daughter-in-law's plan to buy a washing machine on installment, she spoke for those Americans who had never bought anything unless they had the cash in hand. But when Molly's children eventually convinced her that living above our means is the American way, viewers were reassured that uncontrolled shopping was moral, even patriotic. These shows always presented new commodities as the solutions to domestic problems. When Chester Riley took Peg out to a fancy restaurant, or Ralph Cramden bought Alice a new mop, peace was restored. But Lipsitz says that TV also criticized the new consumer culture. Ralph Cramden's weekly threats to send Alice to the moon if she didn't stop mocking his get-rich-quick schemes dramatized some of the tensions within a nuclear family bent on spending money. And characters like Luigi, Molly, and Amos and Andy, who were on the margins both ethnically and economically, were often suspicious of mainstream values. Finally, work on these shows was never depicted as a satisfying end in itself. Characters regarded their jobs as exhausting trade-offs of their time for the money to buy new products that they wouldn't have the leisure to enjoy. The exception to this attitude was Ed Norton, whose enthusiasm for his job as a sewer worker on The Honeymooners identified him as a hopeless sap. Time Passages also discusses the music of Los Lobos, film noir, Mardi Gras ritual, and the novels of Japanese-American John Okada and Native American Leslie Marmon Silko. Although Lipsitz has a fan's enthusiasm for all of these forms, he's careful not to romanticize popular culture. At their worst, he says, TV shows, songs, books, and movies perform the dirty work of the state. But at their best, they retain memories of the past and challenge the inequities of the present. Time Passages should convince anybody who still thinks that high culture is the key to understanding history that sometimes sideshows are the main event.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Time Passages by George Lipsitz is published by the University of Minnesota Press. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a rhythm and blues concert with singer and pianist Charles Brown. Brown had a string of hits in the 40s and 50s. His records are being reissued, and his work is being discovered by a new audience. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.